Okay, I'm going to speak next. My name's Paul Armentano. For those of you who don't know me, I'm the senior policy analyst at Normal. I do a lot of the writing. Thank you. I do a lot of the writing. I do a lot of the research for Normal. And, you know, it's funny. Yesterday we had a panel on rhetoric and messaging, and I appreciate that panel. I appreciate the points that were made. But I got to tell you, I'm not a fan of rhetoric. I'm not a fan of messaging. To me, this is a real simple issue. The government lies. We tell the truth. That's the end of it. And this idea that we need to use rhetoric and hone our message, sometimes it offends me because the bottom line is the government is lying. We have the facts on our side, and what we need to do is get those facts out there. And with that said, I'm going to give a presentation on marijuana use and cannabinoids and the brain. And in a nutshell, this paper, which you can actually read the full paper on our website, is a good example of the fact that the government is lying when they talk about marijuana and when they talk about how the components of marijuana interact with the brain. Your government wouldn't lie, would you? Here's what drug czar John Walters has to say about marijuana and the brain. Smoked marijuana damages the brain, impairs learning, and contains cancer-causing compounds. That's what he says. What's the science say? The first topic I'm going to talk about, and one of the speakers yesterday, actually Ed Rosenthal, touched on this, is this concept of neurogenesis. Literally, neurogenesis is defined as the birth of new neurons. This is a process that takes place most often in prenatal development, and we've also fairly recently discovered that there's also adult neurogenesis too, and it is believed that this process helps to enable organisms to adapt to their environment and influence their learning and memory throughout life. Interestingly, most so-called drugs of abuse, including opiates, alcohol, nicotine, and cocaine, suppress the formation of new neurons in the brain. Marijuana, however, we've discovered, actually has the opposite effect. This was based on a paper published last fall by an international research team out of the University of Saskatchewan. What they did was they took rats and they administered them a synthetic cannabinoid known as HU210. They administered the rats that twice a day for 10 days. Then they waited 1 month after they did this, and they investigated. They looked at the hippocampus part of the brain, and what they found was, and I quote, and you can read it up there, "We show that 1 month after chronic HU210 treatment, rats displayed increased newborn neurons in the hippocampus." And arguably, as importantly, they found no neuronal death following chronic HU210 treatment in adult rats. They concluded, "Cannabinoids appear to be the only illicit drug whose capacity to produce increased hippocampal newborn neurons is positively correlated with its anti-anxiety and antidepressant-like effects." One of the reasons I really point this out, too, is they're talking about the part of the brain, the hippocampus, that's involved in forming memories. And it is often told, and drug czar John Walters continues to say, not only does marijuana harm the brain specifically, it harms the brain that's involved in the formation of new memories, particularly it harms the hippocampus. This is actually a study that says, unlike alcohol, unlike nicotine, unlike cocaine, the administration at least of this cannabinoid seemed to proliferate neuronal growth in that part of the brain. You might be wondering how they measure anti-anxiety and anti-depression effects in rats. It's actually quite interesting. What they do is they move them to a new environment, and they wait to see how long it takes them to eat. And if the rats eat more quickly, they assume they're less depressed. I actually think the fact they were giving them this very strong synthetic cannabinoid twice a day for 10 days, the rats may have just had the munchies. But in this case, they also concluded that they happened to be less depressed in addition to having stimulating this growth of new brain cells in the hippocampal part of the brain. Another aspect that I want to talk about, cannabis and neuroprotection. Animal studies have shown now for some time that the administration of certain cannabinoids can protect brain cells from dying in cases of stroke, alcohol poisoning, and neurotoxicity associated with a number of ailments, a couple of those being Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, and traumatic brain injury. 1998, proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. This was a study that actually did get some favorable press in this country, probably because it was done by the National Institutes of Mental Health. What they discovered was in animals, I'm sorry, I don't believe they did this one in animals. This was actually a study that was done in culture. But what they discovered was that CBD, which is a non-psychoactive cannabinoid, I'm sorry, this was in animals. I've got actually a lot of studies to go through, and sometimes I get mixed up. What they did was they stimulated the overproduction of a neurotransmitter called a glutamate. Glutamate, when it's overproduced, kills brain cells. Generally, when there's blunt head trauma or even in cases of stroke, the body overproduces this chemical, and that's what leads to brain death when people have those injuries or ailments. What they did was they stimulated this neurotransmitter in rats. They did it for 10 minutes, and then they gave them CBD to see if, in fact, it would protect the rat brain. What they found out, in fact, was that when they gave them CBD, and in some cases when they gave them Delta-9 THC, it did protect the rat brain from cell death, and they did it better than a vitamin C and vitamin E, which are commonly administered antioxidants. They concluded that these data also suggest that the naturally occurring non-psychotropic cannabinoid cannabidiol may be potentially useful as a therapeutic agent for the treatment of neurological disorders such as cerebral ischemia, which is a condition that is involved with strokes. They also, when they did this study, they actually gave very low doses to the rats, and the scientists believe that had they given higher doses to the rats, it actually would have been even more effective. If we jump to 2005, CBD in rats, it's also neuroprotective in cases of cerebral infarction, which is localized cell death in the brain because of reduced blood flow. This also generally happens in cases of stroke. They gave CBD for 24 hours after they induced this situation, and what they found was treatment of CBD significantly reduced the infarct volume in mice in a dose-dependent manner. In other words, the more CBD they gave, the better the results. The less CBD they gave, the results weren't as favorable. They concluded that CBD exerts a neuroprotective effect through its antioxidant, antispasmodic, anti-emetic, which means anti-nauseant, as well as through vasorelaxation. Really not surprising when you begin to understand cannabinoids and the endocannabinoid system, something one of our speakers, Bob Melamy, is going to talk about more. We jumped to 2005, National Institutes of Mental Health, once again looking at rats. God forbid we could ever do any of these studies in people. Marijuana might be too dangerous or toxic. What they found in this case was, ironically, if you administer CBD to rats at the same time you give them very high doses and dangerous doses of alcohol, that marijuana actually protects the brain against alcohol poisoning in a dose-dependent fashion. Once again, they found that the brain was most protected in the hippocampus part of the brain. Once again, the effect was dose-dependent compared to controls, the rat section, than the untreated controls. In this case, the CBD did perform better than the diuretics. They concluded that this study provides the first demonstration of CBD as a neuroprotectant in preventing ethanol-induced brain injury. We know through working with groups like SAFER that there's at least every year 20,000 deaths. Cannabidiol can help. With these four studies, talk about neuroprotection. Some of you may be familiar with an agent called dexanabinol. It was a synthetic drug produced by an Israeli company known as Pharmos. And it was produced for the treatment of neuroprotection in cases of traumatic brain injury. It performed very well in phase 1 studies. It performed well in phase 2 studies. They did a major worldwide phase 3 trial looking at whether patients who were brought into a hospital after sustaining severe head injury, whether the administration of dexanabinol would help protect their brain cells. Case point, the brain damage was probably irreversible. I don't know that. I'm not a scientist. But I do want to point out that when we're talking about some of these findings in animals, we can't necessarily conclude that the same thing would happen in humans. This is a case in humans, and in the phase 3 trial, it didn't, despite the fact that in animals, it very clearly has shown this neuroprotective effect. Something else I want to talk about, this is very interesting studies that actually show that cannabinoids can work effectively as anti-cancer agents. The surgery and standard medical treatments left untreated, patients all do seem to respond well to cannabinoids. Why do I say that? Well, in 2000, Nature Medicine reported the findings from a Spanish research team led by Manuel Guzman. He showed that if you injected THC actually into the tumor, then it induced considerable regression of malignant brain tumors in one-third of rats treated and prolonged the survival of another third. They concluded these results may provide the basis for a new therapeutic approach to the treatment of malignant gliomas. One thing I do want to point out in this was a preliminary study in culture, but they used very low doses of THC, and they also took rats that had a very short period of time to live. Yet, despite the fact that they do that, that they did that, they were able to prolong the survival in actually a third of these rats. The researchers were actually shocked by this this finding, and they commented that here again, were they to have taken rats that did have longer to live, or if they had administered a greater amount of THC, they probably would have had even better results. Despite the fact that these results on the on their surface are pretty pretty darn impressive. This was a research team from Italy. They actually looked at both in animals and in human cell lines what happens if you administer, once again, this non-psychoactive component of marijuana known as CBD in human glioma cells. What they found was the addition of CBD in the culture medium led to a dramatic drop in the viability of glioma cells in a concentration-dependent manner. That simply means, once again, the more they gave, the better effect it had. Scientists further demonstrated that the administration of CBD in mice significantly inhibited the growth of implanted human glioma cells, and it was doing this via a process known as apoptosis, which is another way of saying cell suicide. The cell actually turns on itself and kills itself. They concluded that CBD produces a significant anti-tumor activity both in animals and in culture, thus suggesting a possible application of CBD as an anti-cancer agent. Once again, we're back to Spain. You'll notice a trend here. Very few of these studies take place in the United States. Not coincidental, by the way, that that is actually taking place. This is September 2004. This was a review also led by Manuel Guzman's team. Actually, I think this is a very important review for the findings that I've put there on the screen. As it notes, generally, when we try to treat glioma, we don't do it very well. The patient still dies. During the last few years, several studies have shown that cannabinoids slow the growth of different types of tumors, including brain tumors in laboratory animals. This is very important, point three. Cannabinoids induce, they seem to go about killing these tumors two ways. One way is this idea of cell death that I mentioned earlier. The other way is that the cannabinoids seem to cut off the blood flow to the tumors. And without the blood going to the tumor withers and dies. So it's actually a two-pronged sort of strategy. For the tumors that are already there, administration of cannabinoids seem to trigger the tumor to actually kill itself. For the tumors that are just forming, it seems to cut off the blood flow so they do not come to fruition. Something else that's actually fairly remarkable, this is point four, even the scientists noted this was remarkable. Cannabinoids kill glioma cells selectively and can protect non-transformed cells from death. What that means is that cannabinoids seem to discern between the healthy cells and the malignant cells. It leaves the healthy cells alone. It attacks the malignant cells and kills them. That's something standard chemotherapy doesn't do. That's why people get very sick when they're given chemotherapy, because chemotherapy isn't selective. It attacks the cancerous cells. It attacks the healthy cells. And people get very, very ill when that happens. So the idea of having an agent that can selectively go after tumor cells while leaving healthy cells alone, there again, is fairly groundbreaking. And is, I'm somewhat offended by the fact that our government is not either encouraging this sort of research, funding this research, or even acknowledging it exists. The conclusion of this team from Spain was these and other findings reviewed here might set the basis for a potential use of cannabinoids in the management of gliomas. You'll notice that's a fairly common refrain. We do a study and then we determine that this is very hopeful and maybe someday down the road it will be the basis for new therapy. I've been hearing that for about 20 years. I'm starting to wonder when this new therapy will begin. They did try to follow up this study in humans in Spain. As far as I know, it's the first time that a study has been done on human subjects with brain cancer. It was done on 9 terminal patients. They were given about 3 months to live. And at that point, they were allowed to have cannabis. And what they discovered was in these 9 patients, they did have a reduction of brain tumor growth. All the patients did die. Which was not unexpected because they did only have 3 months to live, but they did see a reduction in the actual tumor growth. I'll be interested to see if this study gets written up. The reason I know about it was because I had the fortune a couple weeks ago to travel to Santa Barbara to the Patients Out of Time conference, which was an excellent conference for people who are interested in these and other sort of health-related medical issues. And they did bring in one of the researcher from Spain, and we talked quite a bit about this human study. And hopefully it'll be written up in a journal sometime soon so we can talk about it. Finally, on the subject of neuroprotection, and this, believe it or not, was a study that was actually done in the States. It was actually done at California Pacific Medical Center, which I believe is here in San Francisco. What they were looking at here was, once again, can this non-psychoactive cannabinoid CBD, how it interacts with human glioma cell lines. And once again, they discovered not only that, in this case, CBD, but also THC led to a reduction of these particular cells, but they compared it to a synthetic, what's known as an agonist, a synthetic agent that mimics the effects of cannabinoids and binds to the same receptors. And what they said was that the same concentration of delta-9 THC that significantly inhibits the proliferation and increases death in human glioma cells had no significant impact on primary glial cultures. Evidence of selective efficacy with the synthetic agonist was also observed, but the selectivity was less profound. What that means in layman terms is that the natural cannabinoids were very selective. They went after the malignant cells. They avoided the healthy cells. When they gave the synthetic agent, it was also selective, but it was not as selective as the cannabinoids were. In short term, marijuana worked better than the synthetic agent. I doubt anyone here would be surprised to hear that. Another topic I want to talk about briefly, this idea of cannabinoids and neurodegeneration. There's a number of neurodegenerative diseases that have been studied for some time. Mostly we've talked about marijuana and how it provides symptomatic relief to some of these diseases, particularly multiple sclerosis. What we're finding out now is that rather than just symptomatic relief, cannabinoids can actually slow down the progression of some of these very serious diseases like MS, like Parkinson's disease, like Alzheimer's, and like Lou Gehrig's disease. Why do I say that? There was a very important study that was published in 2003 by a research team out of the University College of London. I know Bob Mellamy talks about this study quite a bit too. What they were doing was they gave animals a model of multiple sclerosis. They gave them allergic encephalomyelitis, and then they gave them cannabinoids. And what they found out, that in addition to symptom management, cannabis may also slow down the neurodegenerative processes that ultimately lead to chronic disability and MS and probably other diseases. Essentially, what they found out was marijuana wasn't giving just symptomatic relief. It was actually slowing down the progression of the disease itself. Another neurodegenerative disease, Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, was studied by a research team once again at California Pacific Medical Center here in San Francisco. As most people know, we have very little effective treatments for Lou Gehrig's disease. In this case, it was reported that Delta-9 THC was effective when it was before the onset of ALS symptoms in a mouse model. It delayed some of the symptoms of the disease, but more importantly, it actually prolonged survival in the treated mice compared to the untreated mice. They concluded that Delta-9 THC was well tolerated, and in fact, it and other cannabinoids may prove down the line to be a novel therapeutic target for the treatment of ALS. Alzheimer's disease, this was a study done in Spain once again. They took human brain tissue from patients that had Alzheimer's disease that had died. And when they examined the brain tissue, one commonality they found was that the endocannabinoid receptors in the brain of these patients that had Alzheimer's disease, they hadn't been working well at all when compared to controls. So when they found that, they said, okay, well, let's test this theory in rats. So they injected rats with a chemical that would bring about cognitive decline, and then they gave them cannabinoids. And what they found out was, as you see in the conclusion, cannabinoids succeeded in preventing the neurodegenerative process occurring in Alzheimer's disease. You know, once again, we're talking about this idea of memory and the fact that for years the federal government has told you that smoking marijuana kills brain cells, smoking marijuana kills your memory. Now they're talking about it actually delaying the onset of Alzheimer's disease. I find the irony quite remarkable, if once again somewhat quite offensive. Lastly, I want to talk a little bit about this idea of what is the effect of marijuana on the brain and cognition. We know what the government says, but what does the science say? This is a study actually that was done in 2001 out of Harvard by a lead researcher named Harrison Pope. I actually think this is a fairly important study. It's one of the better ones that has been done on this subject. In these cases, most of these studies are done in the United States. The government has no problem giving marijuana and having humans smoke it because when they're looking for cognitive deficits, so it's much more easier to get these studies funded. This was a study where they actually had 180 subjects. 63 of the subjects were considered to be current or heavy users. That was defined as having smoked at least 5,000 or more times. There were 45 former heavy users, which mean at some point in their life they had smoked marijuana at least 5,000 times. And then they had 72 controls, which meant that they had defined themselves as having smoked marijuana less than 50 times. What they found out was that long-term cannabis smokers who abstained from the drug for 1 week showed virtually no significant differences from control subjects on a battery of 10 neuropsychological tests. Former heavy users who had consumed little or no cannabis in the 3 months prior to testing also showed no significant differences from control subjects on any of these tests on any testing days. I should add that they tested these subjects at 1 day, 7 days later, then 28 days later. They concluded that while they did note some minor cognitive deficits detectable in the very heavy users for 7 days, these effects did not appear to be long-lived. And in fact, at 28 days, even the long-term users tested exactly the same as the controls on this battery of 10 neuropsychological tests. Canadian researcher Peter Fried, he's been tracking a group of children now for about, well, they're adults now, from the day they were born until about age 25 or so. He wanted to see if marijuana might have any effect on IQ. And I think he was fairly surprised with what his results found. He had 70 volunteers in this study. They were aged 17 to 20. What he did was he did a measure of, he had tested their IQ when they were between 9 and 12 years of age, believed to be before they may have a time preceding any sort of marijuana use, and then later between ages 17 and 20, he broke them into different groups, heavy users, former heavy users, controls, and once again did some IQ examinations on intelligence quotient. And this is what he found fairly interestingly. The current heavy users of marijuana actually had their IQs tested at 4 points lower than the control group. And he defined heavy users as 5 joints per week. But what's even more interesting is that when compared to the what he called light users, which mean they regularly use marijuana but they kept their use under 5 joints per week, they actually tested 6 points higher than the group that were former users and hadn't used any marijuana at all. So basically, he found heavy users tested a little lower, former users tested higher, and in the end, he concluded that marijuana does not have a long-term negative impact on global intelligence. It was actually a study for anybody. If you actually looked at the headlines, some headlines said marijuana makes you smarter. Some headlines said marijuana makes you less smart. So they really had their pick of the litter from Fried's work there. But the bottom line is it seemed to have very little impact. This was a study from 2004. It was done at Boston University, their Department of Psychiatry. This was an interesting study because they actually took twin males. Sometimes when these studies are done, it's difficult to determine whether the drug use itself is responsible or that the individual might have had some genetic disposition. And the way they try to try to discern whether one that's the case or not is by taking actual twins and studying them. In this case, you had 54 pairs of twins to get into the study. You had one twin who had been using marijuana, one twin who had said he had never used marijuana. There was 1 year abstention where they hadn't used any marijuana, and there had been no other illicit drug use. They ran these twins through a battery of different tests, including they were looking at general intelligence, executive function, attention, memory, and motor skills. And what they determined was the results indicate an absence of marked long-term residual effects of marijuana use on cognitive abilities. In other words, the marijuana use, the twins that had used marijuana, even if the use had been for some time, didn't test any differently than the identical twin who had never used marijuana. A study from 2005, once again out of Harvard. This was where they were actually looking at brain imaging of marijuana users. They had 22 volunteers in the sample. Mean lifetime use of 20,100 episodes of smoking marijuana, so there was fairly heavy use here. They had 26 controls with no history of use. And they found that when they examined different parts of the brain of the heavy users appeared to be no different than the brains of the non-users. A study from 2006, this was from the Netherlands. Here again, they were looking at functional magnetic resonance imaging. They were actually studying how the brain looked. They had 1 week of abstinence among the frequent but relatively moderate marijuana users, and they found that cannabis users did not differ from controls in terms of overall pattern of brain activity in the regions involved in these cognitive functions. Once again, it was fairly safe to say that even regular long-term use of marijuana does not seem to have any sort of irreversible harms or damage to the brain. Just to wrap up, one of the ironies about this, very few people are probably familiar with this study. Most people in this room probably did read a headline or two about the study from Greece as it was carried all over the media wires. And if you're to believe the headlines, you would have thought that marijuana smoking caused major damage to the brain because that's what was reported. I do want to touch real briefly on the study. It was from Greece. It was published in the journal Neurology. And like I said, this was about a month ago. It involves about 60 subjects. The volunteers all came from a drug treatment program. They were polydrug users. And what they did was they divided the subjects into three groups. 20 of the individuals had been smoking regularly for 10 years. 20 of the individuals had been smoking fairly regularly for a shorter period of time. And then they had 20 controls. They ran these individuals through a battery of tests, and what they found, according to the researchers, was subtle impairment 24 hours after abstinence in the heavy marijuana users in verbal memory recall and executive function. Executive function is actually something very difficult to measure. It is a test that has to do with prioritizing and multitasking. The verbal recall was a test where individuals were given certain words and then they were asked to recall them sometime later. I don't dispute the fact that this researcher probably in this group did find some subtle cognitive, what he defined as cognitive impairment in the heavy users. My issue is that I assume that were these same individuals to be tested 7 days or even a month later, they would have tested the same. My assumption is that the reason they did not do as well on these two battery of tests was not because they had cognitive damage, but it was actually because these were individuals who, by their own admission, had been using marijuana almost daily for 10 years, and suddenly they were without marijuana. I'd be curious if this same battery of tests were done on, say, twice-a-day coffee drinkers first thing in the morning, and they said, hey, we're not going to give you your morning cup of coffee this morning. Instead, we're going to run you through a battery of neuropsychological tests. I have a feeling that the coffee drinkers would not perform as well that first day, not because they're brain damaged, but because they're used to their morning cup of coffee to start the day. I think the same thing was going on in this group of marijuana users, and were they to have been tested a week later or a month later, they would have tested the same, just as Harrison Pope's study found with individuals that had used marijuana over 5,000 times. Fortunately, that doesn't make good copy, and the individuals who were doing the study did not bother to do any follow-up testing. That's why we got the result we got. I don't find it alarming, and I think, as you can see here from the science that we do have, there's enough sufficient science to show that this idea of stoner stupid really only applies to people like the drug czar, and it doesn't apply to adult responsible marijuana users.